as familiar with the law as you should be, test yourself by joining us for The Law Game. It's an entertainment in which three well-known personalities play judge and pronounce their verdicts on fictitious law cases. Here to judge the judges, as always, is your chairman, Shaw Taylor.
Good evening. Well, we hope you at home will play along with us as we listen to the Radio Drama Company acting out tonight's three cases. We've made them up, but they are all based on real cases that were argued in court on the same points of law. When our intrepid interpreters have intoned their deathless prose, I will interrupt them with this sound. And that is when our patently popular panel painstakingly peruse the facts and decide which side won the case and why. And to show my impartiality, I will give all three of them 50 points each to bet with. They can back their confidence or lack of it with as many of those points as they dare. The person with the most points at the end becomes the clever clogs of the week and wins. Tonight's panel should know the rules because they were here last week and they've got sworn statements that they were coerced with nothing but money to come back again for another bash. They are, of course, John Junkin, Sue Pollard and Patrick Moore. Junkin, starting with you. Even the most even-tempered amongst us occasionally comes across a situation that annoys us to the point where we say there ought to be a law against it. Has that ever happened to you? Would you like to see a change in the law at all?
The one that is predominant in my mind at the moment is I think there ought to be a law against politically committed lunatics interfering with the contents of children's libraries. I grew up on a diet of Enid Blyton and William and all those wonderful books which are now said to be racist and sexist.
The only thing, John, is you say you grew up on them and look at you now. Sue Pollard, hello. You've got friends in tonight. Sue Pollard, apart from Joe Mappin or Miss Cathcart in IDI, what else has made you angry enough to want a law against it?
You see, you're just watching a fantastic programme and suddenly, you know, it's time for the cup of tea. And the TV commercials come on and you have to turn the flipping television down. They do it because they know you're on the toilet, so you can hear all the adverts while you're on the toilet. Alone to a blue, it's disgusting.
Okay? Patrick Moore, you're a man whose word carries probably as much weight as you do. What pet peeve of yours would you like to put right with a new law?
Well, I would like to see one particular law coming to curb one act of British rail. And if you go to any mainline station, you have to get a ticket. It's always the same thing. There are five ticket windows there. One is open and a queue a mile long. I mean, of course, by the time you got there, well, the train usually hasn't gone because it's always so late. But otherwise, it would have done.
You've carried the audience with you. I can't say you've carried British Rail, but you've carried the audience. Well, we've heard from the panel. Let's go over to the Radio Drama Company as they present us with tonight's first case. It's got to do with the selling of a flat. The owner of the flat had recently moved out himself and hired his brother-in-law to get the place in shape, he said, so he could ask a good price. Let's join the two men after the work has been completed.
Well, looks good, Terry. You've done better than I expected. That wood panelling looks really classy.
Oh, yeah, it serves the purpose. It's nailed to battens an inch and a half from the wall.
Oh, clever, that.
Yeah, there's no way the damp's going to show through that.
Was the wood expensive?
Oh, it was a lot cheaper than scraping off the wallpaper and stripping the plaster back to the brickwork, waiting a week for it to dry out, treating it with rubber solution and replastering it all again. And I did that whole wall in one day.
Oh, cheap and cheerful, exactly what I wanted.
I used the wood I had left over on the passage walls here. That way it sort of matches up and don't look too obvious.
You're a genius, Terry.
Wait till you see the bedroom. Yeah, have a look in there, look.
Oh, ceiling tiles.
Yeah. I know I said I'll fill it and give it a couple of coats of paint, but those tiles hide the leaks much better. They're also on a one-inch batten with ardboard nailed to it, and the tiles are stuck to the ardboard.
Well, it makes the ceiling slightly lower, but anyone who hasn't been here before wouldn't know the difference.
No, of course, none of this is going to fool an expert. I mean, a surveyor's only got to put his little damp measuring machine up against the ceiling and all that wall need know right away.
Well, not everyone calls in a surveyor.
Oh, I wouldn't buy a place without one. And you have one for your new place.
Yeah, Terry, but you and I, we're careful. This lady who's coming round to see the flat, she's Dutch or something.
Oh, yeah?
And by the sound of it, she's got pots of money. She saw the advert and said it's just what she's been looking for.
That won't stop her getting a surveyor in.
Well, it might if I put a bit of pressure on. It's only 5-2, she's early.
Oh, good. Must mean she's keen. Well, you won't need me around, will you?
No, but play along with what I say for a moment, yeah?
Mr. Wilde?
Mrs. Van der Halter? You're early. This gentleman's just been looking over the flat ahead of you, and, well, he's made me a pretty good offer.
Oh, yeah.
I told him I'd already fix your appointment and would offer you first refusal as long as you meet the asking price. Well, thanks for coming, Mr. Dorning, and I'll be in touch with you later this afternoon.
All right. I really like the place, and since it's already decorated in such good condition, I'm prepared to up my offer by another 1,000 if I have to.
Well, I'll bear that in mind. You'll have a definite decision by tonight at the latest.
Thanks, Mr. Wilde. Ta-ra for now, then. Oh, goodbye, Mrs. Sander.
Yeah, well, come in and look round, Mrs. Van der Halter. Shall we start with the kitchen?
Oh, it's beautiful. Oh, plenty of cupboard space.
Oh, yes, you'll find the flat has everything you need. And as Mr. Dorning said, it's in good condition throughout. However, as you heard, he wants it too, so you'll have to make up your mind pretty quick. I promised him an answer tonight.
Oh, I don't normally like being rushed into a yes or no like that. But it looks like I've got no choice. You couldn't possibly wait till my brother gets here next week. He knows more about property than I do.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. Van der Halter. I'm afraid it has to be now.
Oh, well, okay. Let's look at the lounge and bedroom. If they look as good as this kitchen, I'll take it.
Now, Mrs. Van der Halter agreed to pay her deposit right away and bought the flat as soon as the contract could be exchanged. 6 months later, she decided to change the decor and discover the hidden damp. And it was proved to have been there before she took possession. So she sued Mr. Wilde, among other things, for damages for deceit. But did she win our claim or didn't she, John Junkin?
Ooh. I don't think there is any law that says you can't decorate your flat by putting tiles on a batten and putting them 3 inches away from the ceiling or the wall. And I would have thought that if she wanted to make sure that the place was in acceptable condition, it was up to her. At no time in the conversation we heard did the gentleman say that it was in perfect condition. I would have thought she lost.
Yeah, didn't take. She could have had a survey, couldn't she?
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't, so she lost. A case of caveat emptor. What do you think, Sue Pollard? Do you think this is a case of caveat emptor?
Well, I don't know, but I've had a bad case of flu recently, anyway. I've got to agree with actually everything that John's just said previously. I mean, it seems to me it comes down to a matter of conscience. The guy's obviously thinking I'm onto a good thing here, so he's obviously conned his way to get rid of everything dead quick. Yeah. He's had his cohort with him. I just feel that
a case of
if
damages...
I was the judge, I'd have to say, I'm very sorry, but I really feel you've got no case here.
You've
and
not
I'm
proved.
The judge, aren't I?
You are the judge?
Yes, of course I am. I'm very sorry. Case dismissed.
Oh, dear. Well, now, Patrick Moore. They both said that poor Mrs. Van der Harker has lost her case. What do you think?
Well, I don't think you can have anyone up for deceit. Oswald, if you could, what would happen to the House of Commons? I think she lost her case for two reasons. First of all, because she didn't have a surveyor's report.
Right.
And secondly, there's nothing in the conversation that we heard, except the clandestine one that she didn't hear, that indicates that Mr. Wilde himself knew there was anything wrong.
Oh.
Therefore, because there's no actual proof that he knew, he might well have handed it over to someone else and taken it at face value.
Right.
And because of that, and because she didn't get a surveyor's report, because you can't sue for deceit, I think she lost her case.
Poor Mrs. Van der Harter. Well, now, all three of you say she lost. What points will you bet, John Junkin? 50 each you've got? What will you get?
What points will I bet? At any other stage of my life, I would bet 50, but because we have all three been unanimous...
Right.
I don't trust you or Brad Ashton up a wet step. I will therefore bet 25.
You'll bet 25. All right. Sue Pollard, what will you bet? You've got 50 points.
30.
30?
Yes.
All right. Patrick Moore.
35. I'm being bold, you see. 35.
No hesitation there, was there? Right, you all say that she lost her case. Mrs. van der Hulta won her case.
I know nothing about the law, but I know these two.
What's the reason, then?
Well, the fact is, Sue, I mean, you threw caveat emptor aside like an old boot, didn't you?
Well, I don't know what it means, but I can't even say it. I've got a clue.
It means buyer beware. She should have checked the place over properly before buying. That's what Mr. Wilde said. Oh. But the court didn't hold that up in this instance because she'd been induced by fraud to enter into a contract of purchase. And they said it was fraud. You could sue for deceit. And they found in her favour. Let's go to case two. This is set in court, but of course it's the law game version of a court, which tends to speed up the procedure and squeeze as many cases into the show as possible. This one has the defendant charged under the 1972 Road Traffic Act with careless driving. For details, let's listen as the prosecuting counsel questions the driver concerned.
Miss Cookson, how long have you been driving the car?
12 years. Nearly 13, actually.
And is this the first serious accident you've been involved in?
No, it's the third. But in the two previous cases, it was the fault of the other drivers. That was accepted by my insurance company. My no-claims bonus was kept intact.
But nevertheless, you seem to be prone to accidents.
The last one was 8 years ago. I'd hardly call that prone.
The car you were driving when you had this latest accident was borrowed, was it not?
Yes. My own one was being serviced and having a new gearbox fitted. I needed to attend a meeting in Manchester and persuaded my friend to lend me his car.
Had you driven this particular car before?
Yes, once before. Last winter when my own car's battery went dead on me and I needed to be somewhere in a hurry. So yes, I was familiar with the car.
But had you driven it on the motorway? And at anything like the speed you were doing just prior to the accident?
No. Oh, yes, I have. I drove it a short way on the M25 between Potter's Bar and Enfield.
Indeed, a short way. About 5 miles at most.
But it was on the motorway.
At night?
No, it was mid-morning, actually.
So let's be quite clear about this. The accident occurred whilst you were driving a car, comparatively strange to you, on a long stretch of motorway at night. And because you were unfamiliar with the vehicle, when a mechanical fault caused the headlamps to shut off, you panicked and drove off the road onto the hard shoulder and into an unlit van already parked there.
I did not panic. I just had to think quickly. There was a stream of fast-moving cars behind me. I knew if I slowed down, they'd run into the back of me. So I pulled over to the hard shoulder out of their way.
And straight into the van, injuring the driver asleep in the front seat. An injury entirely caused by your careless driving.
I had no idea the headlamps would suddenly fail.
A careful driver, Miss Cookson, is one who is prepared for all the things that can go wrong with a vehicle and does not get into a flap when any of those things suddenly happen.
I did not flap. I did the safest thing that occurred to me at the time. I was not to know that the van was parked there. It had no warning lights or reflecting triangles.
And you're suggesting it's the van driver's fault you ran into him? Surely it's you, Miss Cookson, who should have switched on your hazard lights immediately to warn the drivers behind you, and then slowed down, giving yourself enough time to ease onto the hard shoulder. I've no further questions, sir.
I have, sir, if I may. Miss Cookson, before borrowing your friend's car that day, did you check its condition?
Yes. When I put the petrol in, I checked all the tyres and the water and the oil and made sure the windows were clean and that the windscreen wipers were working.
And what about the lights? Did you check if they were working?
They were already on. I'd set out on the journey after lighting up time.
Is there any way that you, as a typical driver with average knowledge of the interior workings of a car, could have foreseen that the lights would suddenly fail?
No. No way.
One final question. Would you have acted the same way had you been in the more familiar surroundings of your own car?
Yes, I think I would.
Well, there's the evidence panel. The poor old van driver, he felt a bit tired. He sought a catnap on the hard shoulder, found himself in hospital. and that was caused by Miss Cookson driving into the back of him. So, was she found guilty of driving without due care and attention, or was she not, Sue Pollard?
I actually feel that in the circumstances, the lady, she did the right thing. You know, she... I mean, obviously, you get into a bit of a flap, don't you? And yeah. I blame the van driver. I mean, quite honestly, of course, he was tired and everything. You can't say when you're going to nod off, but he should have had the presence of mind to have realised, A, you don't drive over anyway. You can't nod off on a hard shoulder anyway, can you?
I don't think it's legal to have a kip on the hard shoulder, quite frankly.
No, it isn't at all, is it?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, you can't even, you're not even supposed to pull over if you're having a heart attack at the wheel, no. Really. I mean, you're supposed to drive on to the nearest hospital, you know, and gasp and say, I'm dying, you know, but I avoided the hard shoulder.
Yeah. You'd let her off.
Yes, I'm just so glad that I just go by cab. That's all I can say.
Let me come to Patrick Moore and see how you feel about this.
Well, of course, it is quite illegal to draw and park on the hard shoulder except in an emergency. Mm-hmm. And although I think there have been cases when a driver's been overtired, has pleaded that this was an emergency, I very much doubt that that would hold up here. Also, if you're going to check every darn thing on your car before setting out, lights and all, see whether they're going to tip over or what have you, you would never actually go anywhere at all. Whether you're going to think about the car or not. That might be a good idea. That's hardly the point. So as far as I can see, although it was very bad luck on the van driver, he shouldn't have been there, and it really was not her fault at all.
Not her fault.
I think probably she was found guilty, but I'm going to say she wasn't, but that's the legal. So I would say she was found not guilty.
Right. You've hedged your bets. John Junkin, are you quite clear on this?
I'm clear on everything except Patrick's statement. I must say I tend to agree with him. There are so many anomalies with the car. For many, many years, it was illegal in this country to sound your horn while the car was stationary.
True.
And it was also illegal to drive your car away without first ascertaining that the horn was in working order. This is true, I can assure you. Yeah. I think that has been amended, but that at least was the case. The counsel who said you should be prepared for all things to happen with a car, I think is living in cloud cuckoo land, because the things that can happen to cars are frightening. I think the lady was eminently sensible. I think considering what happens on a motorway, considering the speed of cars on a motorway, to drive off onto the hard shoulder showed enormous presence of mind. If she knew the law, and the law says that you're not allowed to park on the hard shoulder, she should have been fairly confident that she could be able to drive onto the hard shoulder in comparative safety rather than stop dead on the motorway and possibly cause a major crash. I agree with Patrick. I don't know what the law says, but as far as I'm concerned, she should get off.
Right. Now, all three of you. Let us look at the point situation. John Junkin, you've got 25. Sue Pollard, you've got 20. Patrick Moore, you've got 15. Sue, you are the first to bet your 20 points that she was found not guilty.
I'll bet 17. I'll bet 17 that she was acquitted.
Oh,
Bill. You've said it now, haven't you? Patrick Moore, what will you bet? You've got 15 points.
I may be rather mistrustful of you. Please don't get me wrong.
No.
But I have a sort of feeling that in setting this question, you know as well as I do that the motorist is always found guilty, whether he is or not. So on this occasion, because I think you're trying to double-cross us, how many points have I got left?
You've got 15.
14.
It's going to be a great last case. John Junkin, 25 points you've got.
I like a gamble. 22.
22, right. You all three say Miss Cookson was found not guilty. Miss Cookson was found not guilty. Held that considering she was faced with an emergency during the course of driving, she had acted reasonably in the circumstances. Though the prosecuting counsel is expected to act perfectly, no motorist, said the magistrate, can be expected to achieve that standard when confronted with an emergency. Now, oddly enough, the prosecuting counsel did not ask her to act perfectly because he suggested she should switch her hazard lights on before she came off the motorway onto the hard shoulder.
And, believe it or not, under motorway regulations, it is an offence to have your hazard light on while you are moving. Now, I think that is a nonsense law myself, yes. Because I find on a motorway, yes. If there's trouble up ahead, if some other guy puts his hazard lights on in front of me, it gives me a warning. Yes. So if you ask me, is there a law I would like changed,
yes.
That's the one I would like, yes. Changed. Very interesting, very interesting gambling here. We've got John Junkin in the lead with 47 points, Sue Pollard with 37, Patrick, you have 29. So case number three coming up now. It's one in which a group of parents form themselves into a committee to complain to their local council. The chairperson, note that, the chairperson and her deputy went to see the education officer with their complaint.
I think you're rather jumping the gun here, Mrs. Vincent. The council are merely considering the possibility at the moment. There are no definite plans to close Old Farm Boys School.
Then why have you already approached the headmasters of both Potter's End School and Fenbury Lane to divide the Old Farm Boys up between them?
That was just a preliminary inquiry. Anyway, it was confidential.
The point, Mr. Radcliffe, is that you did approach them, and they were told to be prepared to accept the extra pupils from early next year.
Yes, if the school closure were to go ahead. But as I say, it's still at the discussion stage. We were merely seeing if it was feasible.
But you've made no plans to close down either of the two girls' schools in the area.
No, no, that wasn't felt necessary. Let me put the council's position to you as clearly as I can. It's a matter of finance. With grants, school buses, further education courses, evening classes, and the upkeep and staffing of the schools under our control, the council is spending in excess of £1 million a week. But we're not a big authority, as you know.
Cuts can be made. I'm sure if you go into it close enough, you'll find there are areas of wastage.
Hmm. School sports grounds, for instance. Apart from Saturday morning inter-schools matches, they're only used on weekday afternoons. It would be a simple matter to alter the times of the classes so that one sports ground can be used by two schools, one in the morning, the other in the afternoon.
Oh, yes. That's a suggestion that comes up quite regularly, and it gets turned down for practical reasons. When you asked for this meeting today, I was only too pleased to see you. But the matter of closing Old Farm Boys School is something that I'm afraid must be up to the council, not the parents.
I'm sure Mr. Spencer accepts along with me that the council can well do with the revenue that will accrue from the sale of one of the schools, even if the land will just be used for development. But since there are two girls' schools in the area and only one boys' school, why is it that only the boys' school is considered for closure?
As both of you have sons at the boys' school, I do appreciate your concern. But the council's only consideration is to sell off the property that will bring us in the most revenue, and which gives us least problems by having the pupils assimilated in the two other mixed schools.
So what you're saying, in effect, is that you are giving no choice to parents who want their sons to go to a single-sex school from now on, but that those with daughters still have a choice of two such schools.
And that, Mr. Radcliffe, would appear to be a blatant case of sex discrimination.
Oh, it's nothing to do with sex discrimination. It's a pure matter of finance.
Maybe it is from your point of view, but not from ours.
As parents, till now, we have been able to choose single-sex schools for our sons. Closure of Old Farm School will deprive us of that right.
And if the council accepts your advice and decide to close the boys' school, we shall instruct Mr. Clifton on our committee, he's a solicitor, to get the court to stop the closure under the Sex Discrimination Act.
Well, the council made the decision to close the school, and they did go to court. The parents went to court as threatened, but did they win or did they not? Patrick Moore.
Well, when you consider the teaching profession at the moment, the first thing we have to do is to abandon every vestige of common sense. Point number one. Point number two is that you and I both know that the Sex Discrimination Act is aimed purely against the male sex. And therefore, I think the parents lost.
Oh, you think it was against the male sex? Well, no, I come rapid to you, John Junkin, as a reader of books in libraries when you were a small boy. Well, how do you feel about this? Did the parents want?
I think if they'd possibly gone to law under some other pretext, I think they might have had a case. I don't think their case stands up under sex discrimination, unfortunately.
I think sex discrimination was proved.
Mm.
All right, then. What about you, Sue Pollard? Do you see any sex discrimination in this?
I've got here my Pittman shorthand.
Yes?
People on the bandwagon. And parents, at the moment, seem to be
up in arms about the way that their children are educated or not. So therefore they feel that they've got more say in the way that their education is run, which I think is fair.
Yeah.
But in this case, they said, well, we've got to win somehow, so we'll just make it a case of sex discrimination. And I agree with John. I don't think that that would, is a good enough reason to state their case.
So we have a panel here which is united in saying that the parents lost. Patrick Moore, 29 points you have. How many of those will you bet?
29. After all, I had to compete blank last week. Why shouldn't I go for the double?
Geoff Chunkin, you got 47 points.
Have I? I'll join you, Patrick. I'll go the lot.
47?
Yeah.
Sue Pollard.
Oh, timid little
you can either be have integrity or you can win, Sue. Which do you want to do?
I think I'll win because I was nearly losing, wasn't I? How many have I got?
37 points.
I think I'll bet 35. Should I give a big spin then?
No.
Shall I or shan't I? I don't know what to do. All right then, I'll take the money. Oh, no, it's a different game. Do you remember that? Double your money. Oh, sorry. 37 then.
I don't want to worry you, Sue, but I do have to accept your first bet. I'm afraid I've got to accept your bet of 35.
All right, then, John.
So all three of you say that the Parents' Committee lost their case, and I can tell you the Parents' Committee won their case. They got an injunction to stop the council closing the boys' school. The court held that under the 1975 Sex Discrimination Act, the loss of option to have either single-sex or co-educational schooling for boys and not for girls was to treat the boys less favorably and therefore sex discriminatory. And with Sue Pollard betting so sensibly, while Patrick Moore and John Junkin have no points, Sue Pollard has two in his argument. Well, that's not only the last of tonight's cases, it's also the end of this 11th series of the Law Game. However, an appeal has been lodged with the powers that be to consider the benefits of bringing us back again before too long, and we hope to see you then. Meanwhile, I would just say good night. On behalf of tonight's panel of John Junkin, Sue Pollard and Patrick Moore, our radio drama company, who are Natasha Pine, Andrew Branch and Richard Durden, deviser and writer, Brad Ashton, legal advisor, Doug Cracknell, producer, Dan Patterson, and from me, Sean Taylor. Bye-bye for now.